Sheriff is just trying to drag out the investigation, and they remind him that the clock's ticking, just a few more weeks before they stop trying to negotiate and get ready to sue. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Wholesale prices have dropped. Companies paid less for food and energy last month, a sign that inflation remains in check. The Labor Department says the Producer Price Index, which measures price changes, that is, before they reach consumers, edged down 0.1% in December. The index moved up the previous month. Well, U.S. stocks opened slightly higher today on investor hopes for a massive cash infusion at the International Monetary Fund. The IMF says it wants to raise up to $500 billion to hand out new loans and extra protection for financially troubled nations. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Hour 2 of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour of the show, and Kyle Mabry was on for Hour number 1. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about Pakistan, recent events there, more about the relationship between Pakistan and the United States. And we are very happy to be talking once again with Stephen Cohen. He's at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., where he is a senior fellow in foreign policy, has been there at Brookings for a number of years after having spent a number of years here at the University of Illinois as a professor of political science, one of the founders of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. He has authored a number of books dealing with South Asian security issues and has been a longtime follower of the politics of both India and Pakistan and has talked about both of those countries and what's happening in them with us many times. We're very pleased to have him here. He's visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 3 on the topic Pakistan, a continuing crisis and uncertain future. This is sponsored by the program in arms control, disarmament and international security. I'm sure that folks who are interested could stop by. But otherwise, as we talk here this morning, questions are welcome. As always, we just ask people to try and be brief in their questions so we can keep moving along. But questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Email us an option, too. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you have questions, comments, go ahead and pass them along. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I appreciate the invitation to come back to Urbana and also to appear in WILL.
I don't follow politics in Pakistan as closely as you do, but it strikes me that that things have been extraordinarily active there within the past year or so. It's certainly going back to the move into Pakistan that ended up in the death of Osama bin Laden and everything that followed after that.
That precipitated the present crisis, but this follows upon a series of crises. And I've used the phrase, Pakistan is marinated in crisis. And these crises have been ongoing since really 1965. Some people say even before that. And, of course, in a lot of these crises, the United States has been deeply involved, both for good and for bad.
Yeah. Well, just to start with the raid that ended up killing bin Laden, that caused certainly that added to the tension between the governments of Pakistan and the United States, because the Pakistanis said, well, you know, we didn't know anything about this. We weren't informed. And how could you possibly do that without letting us know? And then on the American side, I think there was a lot of talk about, well, didn't you know this guy was there and so forth? You know, what can you say about that?
It's a paradox, and Pakistan is filled with paradox. It's a state rich in paradox. And in this case, the paradox is, were they incompetent or complicit? And I don't really know. I have no inside knowledge about these things. Obviously, the Pakistanis say they were by saying that they didn't know Osama was there, they're admitting they're incompetent. But if they did know he was there, then they're complicit. And, of course, the reason why the Americans didn't to contact the Pakistanis beforehand was that on several occasions when we did contact Pakistan about a particular target we were going to hit, that target moved before we could actually strike. So the distrust of Pakistan is very deep in the U.S. government, especially in the military and the CIA. It's our most dangerous ally.
What are the priorities of the government and the military, and they may be different, that is the Pakistani government and military, when it comes to their neighbor Afghanistan and the United States? I mean, how does that all come
together? Yeah, there's a fundamental difference of interest between the way Pakistanis see their role in Afghanistan and the way in which we see Afghanistan. I think that's been one of the core disagreements between Americans and Pakistanis, and we've never really resolved that difference. That is, the Pakistanis see a sympathetic Afghanistan as in their vital national interest. And by vital, I mean they're willing to use force to bring that about. And the reason they see a sympathetic Afghanistan is in their interest because they see Afghanistan as a natural ally of India. So from the military's point of view in particular, they see the Indian effort in Afghanistan to be a strategy of encirclement, and they're not wrong on that issue. The United States has never faced up to that issue. In fact, by signing the U.S.-India nuclear agreement, which I actually supported, but we proved to the Pakistanis who wanted to see it that way that we were India's new ally. So there's a contradiction in our policy. On the one hand, we don't really fully understand Pakistan's vital interest in Afghanistan. On the other hand, we expect them to cooperate with us. So the Pakistanis wind up on fighting both sides of the war in Afghanistan. They're helping us, actually until recently, they help us get access to Afghanistan, yet they support the Taliban. And the anger against Pakistan actually grew first among the U.S. military. Our soldiers who were sitting in Afghanistan who were being shot at by people coming from Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, you could trace that anger in the 90s as we entered Afghanistan. It then permeated into Congress, and finally the executive branch realized that Pakistan was an ally that was playing both sides of the street.
Yeah. So, well, I think, you know, one of the things that you have argued is that maybe we, what we think and what we say about Pakistan and its nuclear program was maybe mistaken, or at least that it's on the one hand, as far as India and its nuclear weapons, we sort of accommodated ourselves to that. But we said that as far as Pakistan was concerned, that this is something that we couldn't accommodate ourselves to. And you seemed, in some of the things that you have said, seems to be saying, well, you know, we probably should have managed to accommodate ourselves to both.
Well, we've resolved our problems with North Korea. We may eventually resolve our differences with Iran. We certainly did with China. We did with India and, of course, with the Soviet Union. That is, we accepted the fact that these were nuclear weapon states. We worked diplomatically and politically to bring them into sort of a shared international understanding about the risk of being a nuclear weapon state. We haven't done that with Pakistan because there's so much anger in Washington against the fact that Pakistan was one of the major contributors to proliferation itself. In a sense, they supplied the Iraqis, the Iranians, a bunch of other countries with nuclear technology. We didn't have that anger towards China. And China was really the mother of all proliferators because they proliferated to both North Korea and Pakistan. But the administration of those years felt that relations with China were so important, we couldn't scold them for their proliferation activities. So the Pakistanis feel, I think justly so, that we favor India over Pakistan for irrational reasons. This doesn't mean that their Pakistani policy hasn't been itself kind of self-defeating and dangerous. It has been. In fact, they're the world's largest producer of nuclear weapons right now. They exceed even the Chinese, apparently, in terms of production of nuclear weapons. And in a few years, they will have 200 nuclear weapons, far more than India, far more than – they'll be up ahead of the French and the British. And this is, you know, from their point of view, the more nuclear warheads you have, the better you are, the more secure you are, which I think is a totally false belief.
Yeah. Well, how worried should the United States be about the security of the weapons that Pakistan has?
I think it's one of the major legitimate concerns we have about Pakistan. And when you tell Pakistanis this, they get angry and insulted. They say, how dare you treat us like an irresponsible state? But they have been irresponsible. We should be concerned. That's one of the paradoxes of nuclear weapons. They make Pakistan more secure in the sense that the Indians will not invade Pakistan. But the fact that you have nuclear weapons and fissile material floating around your country makes them vulnerable to theft and diversion. In fact, Pakistan is next to North Korea in terms of the riskiness of their nuclear weapons program. There are four Asian countries on that list that sort of top the list. Five, actually, total five countries. India, China, Pakistan, North Korea, with Israel right in there, because there's the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which actually is run by a U of I grad, Joan Rolfing. They completed a major study just publicized last week. And there's a really good methodology in terms of a number of 10, 15, 20 variables in terms of how you measure nuclear risk. And the Chinese, the Indians, the Pakistanis, the North Koreans come out on top, with the Israelis there also. And this involves the amount of fissile material, known safeguards, the transparency of the system, and the political stability of a country. Then Pakistan is only next to North Korea in terms of the risk, nuclear risk that they pose. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Steve Cohen. He's at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., was for a long time here professor of political science at University of Illinois, one of the country's leading authorities on Pakistan and its politics. He's here for a visit. He was good enough to come spend some time talking with us, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, we touched on a little bit about the tension, not necessarily new, between the government of Pakistan and the United States. They're all within Pakistan. They're also, again, this perhaps goes at least as far back as the raid that killed bin Laden. Some significant tension between the government and the military.
Yeah, yeah.
All of this involving this incident, which has come to be known as Memogate.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happened was there was someone circulated this unsigned memo that was written after the killing of bin Laden, asking for United States help in preventing a military coup. No one knows exactly who was responsible. Yeah. The president, Mr. Zardari, got the blame, and I think that the Pakistani representative to Washington ended up having to resign, although he said, no, I didn't have anything to do with this. Tell the story of Memogate and what this is all about.
There was an American involved in this, an American named Ejaz Mansour, American of Pakistani origin, and he surfaced this in a Financial Times op-ed piece. And when you read the memo, which is online, of course, everything is online now, it's really couldn't have been written by anybody of any intelligence. It's kind of a fictitious memo. It's just wildly improbable. And I think that Haqqani has been unjustly and inappropriately accused of treason in the Pakistani press, but there are no formal charges against him. And, of course, I think they're trying to get the president Zardari, because Haqqani is close to Zardari. So Haqqani has resigned as ambassador. A new ambassador has been appointed, and we'll see her in Washington. She's there right now. I think this will resolve itself in that Memogate will go away. They'll release Haqqani, allow him to come back to the United States as a private citizen, and resume probably his teaching duties at Boston University, where he was a professor. But it indicates the deep distrust between the military and the civilians in Pakistan. And that's another paradox of Pakistan. You know, it's if you look at Aristotle, go back to Greek political theory, Pakistan has a mixed constitution. That is, it is part military autocracy and part civilian democracy. And you can't tell at any given moment, especially now, who actually governs Pakistan, whether it's the military or the civilians. Both claim, well, the military don't claim to govern, but in fact they do govern on some issues. So I think that's part of Pakistan's confusion as a state and its identity. And we can't tell. It's a chameleon state. We can't tell what it is at any given moment. Mm-hmm. That's why it's hard for other countries, especially the United States and India, to deal with Pakistan. We don't know whether to deal with the civilians who we should be dealing with or with the military who actually have the power. And you talk to officials in Washington or New Delhi, for example, and they're really confused about who has the power in India and Pakistan. The fact is that both the military need the civilians to provide legitimacy, but the civilians can't govern. I won't say they're all incompetent, but they don't have the levers of power that they should have in a normal democracy.
Yeah. Well, I think I read a comment that you made, something along the lines that the military doesn't know how to govern, but they won't let anybody else do it.
Yeah, the last time I saw Army Chief Kiani, I said to him, sir, you have to be respectful to four-star generals. I said, you can't govern Pakistan, but you won't let the civilians govern, to which his response was, a grunt. You know, he didn't say yes, he didn't say no, but I think the army understands that they're in a deep, deep problem because they can't govern Pakistan. They've tried it and they failed. Zia tried it. Ayub tried it. Musharraf failed spectacularly. So they know they can't govern, but they don't trust the civilians to govern either. And I had a conversation with Pervez Musharraf right after his coup, 1999. And I said, what you need to do is to allow the civilians to govern and to fail. And then if they fail, let the people of Pakistan decide who's going to govern them. You know, the people shall judge in Pakistan. But Musharraf said, no, we're going to throw these Johnnies out. We're going to clean house once and for all. I knew then that he was going to be in deep trouble. And that's part of Pakistan's problems, that some generals have exaggerated their ability to transform the state.
Yeah. So just going back to the issue of the memo, was this then, you think, just a thinly veiled attack by the military on Mr. Zardari?
I don't know. They don't like him because, well, they don't like Haqqani because Haqqani wrote a superb book about the military and politics, really one of these tell-all books. And Haqqani himself had begun on the extreme right of Pakistani politics and moved towards the left, towards being a supporter of Benazir Bhutto. And he wrote this marvelous book, which is still very useful. And because he was involved in so many conspiracies as a journalist and so forth, he knew where the bodies were buried, literally and figuratively. Mm-hmm. So the military did not like that tell-all book. But, and then he became ambassador to the United States. So I think they're out to get him. They don't like him. They distrust him. He doesn't like the military. In a sense, that's plausible. But whether they were involved in this or not, I just don't know. I know they don't like President Zardari for various reasons. But my response to the military is, you know, let them fail on their own terms. Let them govern, and let the people of Pakistan make the decision who's going to govern them. The trouble is, the military can't afford that risk. They've got to manipulate politics. So they're afraid of they might get a leader who's too soft on India or too soft on America right now. Mm-hmm. And actually, they're right in the sense that most civilians are softer on India than are most of the military.
Well, there was at one point there was all this talk about the possibility of a coup, guess I would say, in fact, maybe that it wouldn't have hurt Mr. Zardari to sort of play that up to the United States, just to say, hey, you know,
we just don't know exactly what went on. I think my colleague Bruce Rydell at Brookings has said that it's a slow motion coup. In fact, the military exerting and expanding their power without actually formally taking it over. My view has been for a couple of years now, I wrote this book called The Idea of Pakistan, and the new book is called The Future of Pakistan, is that it doesn't make any difference who governs, in a sense, whether it's a military government or a civilian government. It's the same crowd. It's not really an authentic representation of popular vote, popular opinion. So in a sense, you might have a formal coup in Pakistan, but I don't think it's going to change the system that much.
Our guest in this hour is Stephen Cohen from the Brookings Institution. We're talking about politics in Pakistan, and questions are welcome. In fact, we have somebody here ready to go in Champaign on our line number one, and we will talk with them. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've been following Pakistan since I joined the faculty here and worked with you at ACTUS. And with all due respect to your analysis, it does seem to me that the U.S. foreign policy towards Pakistan is pretty much the same policy we've pursued toward Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And that is to deliberately destabilize Pakistan, force its crack up into its constituent units, as we have done to those other states, and then neutralize the Pakistani nukes, the Islamic bomb, which, of course, we and the Israelis don't want to see. And, of course, we have no problem with the Hindu bomb because we want them to use that against Pakistan and China. So I wonder if you could respond to that. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I think that there's some plausibility in what you argue, but in fact, the record and the talking to people involved in policy doesn't bear that out. Pakistan, like North Korea, is too nuclear to fail. That is, everybody in a position of responsibility dealing with Pakistan, whether Republican or Democrat, this administration or previous administrations, they're afraid of the phenomena of Pakistan breaking up. They don't want to go through the same thing we went through with the Soviet Union, where the big question was, who controls the nuclear weapons? How do you get them under control? In that case, we had the cooperation of the Soviet Union, or what became Russia. That is, we gathered in the nuclear weapons with Russian help, with Soviet help, and then centralized them and got them out of the remnants of the former Soviet Union. In the case of Pakistan, the scenario is very much more uncertain. If you could imagine Nigeria without oil, that's Pakistan. Without nuclear weapons. But nobody who's familiar with this Pakistani system is confident that the Pakistanis have control over the nuclear weapons. But nobody would say that it's easy to get rid of them or to seize them or scoop them up. Pakistanis are obsessed with that. They're afraid that we're going to go in there and grab the nukes and leave. But there are at least 60 nuclear weapons. The Pakistanis are not stupid. They're dispersed around the country. They're maybe moved from one storage depot to another. It's easier to fabricate storage depots, so it's a giant shell game, a pee under the shell game. You know, where are the nuclear weapons at? So the notion of stripping Pakistan of the nuclear weapons is a dream that some Indians have had, but in fact, reality, we just can't do it. It's like going in and scooping up the Soviet nuclear weapons without Soviet cooperation. If Pakistan does break up, you'll see a massive migration of people into the neighboring regions. The Iranians are desperately concerned about this. The Indians are very much concerned about this. And the nuclear weapons would be up for grabs. And right now, there's concern about their safety. So I don't think any American official I've ever met or heard of would see this as a policy of any seriousness. Yugoslavia is another matter. You know, they didn't have nuclear weapons, but we're not going to touch North Korea. We're not going to touch Pakistan because of the nukes.
How many nuclear weapons does India have?
Probably between 70 and 80, something like that. That's the best estimate you can get from the IISS, and their rate of increase is very slow. They have the potential for many more nuclear weapons, but they don't seem to be producing them. The Pakistani perception is that there is a fast-growing, expanding Indian nuclear program. So the Pakistanis are going full steam ahead building nuclear weapons, and the Chinese are providing another reactor, which would double the rate of Pakistani weapons production.
Yeah.
So and we don't really know how secure the Pakistani nuclear weapon program is. There was a recent report by the Nuclear Threat Initiative I mentioned that does rate the Pakistanis as next to the North Koreans in terms of insecurity. The fact that the weapons are unknowable, you really don't know how secure they are, makes a lot of caution in dealing with Pakistan. And I think that if it wasn't for the nuclear weapons, we would be far more tough on Pakistan in terms of our conditionality and so forth.
Yeah, at the risk of going over ground, we've already been, just as far as India is concerned, we there's a reason to feel more secure about the security of the Indian weapons?
No, the NTI report, which is apparently the most authoritative unclassified study done, puts the Indians third most dangerous.
Oh, okay.
You know, and the Israelis are in there also, because we simply don't know about what the Israelis, the Chinese, Indians, and Pakistanis are doing with their nuclear weapons. There's little transparency. Actually, the Americans are not that high either. Compared with other states in possession of fissile material.
Champaign County next. Another caller here. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. The deal with India, which it sounds like you opposed.
No, I actually supported it. But I knew the political consequences with regard to Pakistan. Yeah.
Well, it's basically tantamount to withdrawing from the NPT and making it totally transparent that the U.S. will cooperate with anybody who wants to have nuclear weapons, as long as there are our folks, and it just makes a mockery of international law, it seems to me. And I'm disappointed that you didn't, but I'm not surprised. I guess I wanted to talk about the broader picture. I was speaking with you about Dissent in the Chaos by Ahmed Rashid. I recommended I read the off the beaten path sort of treatises, the ones that don't come out of the think tanks and the academia to some extent, though they seem to. The other book is Crossing Zero, America at War, and it's published by City Lights Press, which gives it credentials as being outside the academic range. But both of them come down to something that Ahmed Rashid and Rustin, with a. The idea of going from the great game to the grand bargain, some kind of grand bargain needs to be established. But the U.S. in supporting India in this way doesn't make it likely that will happen in this contemporary milieu we have, where even the suggestion of negotiation is decried and mocked. I don't know where you stand on that, but. There's a lot there, and I'm sorry it's not as focused as I'd like, but I think there's the other thing is that this idea of breaking up Pakistan, I'm informed by someone who goes to Pakistan frequently and is in Afghanistan now, that every informed Pakistani right left knows about an article in the Army Journal by a Lieutenant Colonel Peters, which has the map.
Yeah, yeah.
And calls for a free Baluchistan, and it's basically more great game, more chessboard.
Yeah, there's a led by Colonel Peters, there's a tiny literature which says call for the breakup of Pakistan. But I've never met an American official or retired official that supports that view, never in my life. And they feel that, not that breaking up Pakistan is an immoral thing to do, it might be immoral, it might be moral, but it's too risky. That is, the risk of a Pakistan with its nuclear weapons spewing out around the world, and especially in anger over the breakup process. If I were a Pakistani, I would consider sharing my nuclear weapons with terrorist groups. If an outside power is going to try to break me up, I simply give a few nuclear weapons to a few terrorist groups, let them bomb the Americans, let them bomb the Indians. You know, I think that's enough of a deterrent. It only takes one nuclear weapon to really deter an attack like that. So I think that's a policy that nobody except Peters takes seriously. The danger is that regardless of American policy, and even if we wanted to keep Pakistan together, that it will spin apart. The book I've just finished analyzes a number of predictions about the future of Pakistan, including Colonel Peters. And I think the consensus view is that for the next 5 or 7 years, this is the view of the group I brought together, Pakistan will sort of muddle through. It'll make its way. It won't collapse. It won't break apart. And no country will try to break it apart. But after 5 to 7 years, my personal view is, and I think that's the view of many of the co-authors in the book I edited, is that we're not quite sure what's going to happen to Pakistan. It's been on a downward slide for decades, and the slide is accelerating. And the fact that it's a nuclear weapon state makes that slide even more dangerous to the rest of the world. And you talk to Pakistanis about this, the military and others. They understand this, but they use this as a bargaining lever. In fact, they're pointing a gun to their own head. And if we collapse, we'll bring you down with us. So that's not an idle threat, especially for the Indians who are Pakistan's neighbors. You know, an angry nuclear Pakistan that was breaking up might bring the Indians down with him. And that's something everybody's concerned about. And I think that puts a great deal of caution in policy towards Pakistan.
Right. I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have again another person here. Is someone in Champaign? We'll go on to them, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I'm a U.S. citizen of Pakistani origin, and I'm very concerned about policies of our government here, U.S. government. I think we are inviting something very bad to happen. We are aiding and abetting that. The reason is we are very possessed by the fighting Taliban, who I think, evil them as they may be, will open our eyes when we are dealing with real Pakistanis who have no jobs, who have atomic bombs. The division of Pakistan will not happen, but there we will be faced with unemployed, educated, sophisticated people, and we are inviting a catastrophe. And I think our policy makers are doing that. They don't wake up. You know, we are supposed to be Taliban.
I get your point. I think you probably understand it, but the audience may not understand it. There are really two kinds of Taliban. There are the original Taliban, who are Afghans, not Pakistanis, but Afghans, who are fighting, in a sense, for their – and they're almost all Pashtuns. They are all Pashtuns. And they're similar to the ideology of al-Qaeda. That is, I wouldn't say it's a global revolutionary idea. It's really – they want to throw the foreigners out of Afghanistan. We're battling them in Afghanistan. But there's also a more dangerous Taliban, and here I agree with you. That is Pakistani citizens who have adopted the ideology of the Taliban. And their enemy is both the United States, but also the Pakistani state. And the Pakistani state has been under attack from their own Taliban, some of whom they've been supported by the military. So the Pakistan's paradox here is that they're supporting one Taliban against the United States in Afghanistan, but they're battling another Taliban in Pakistan itself. Now, I agree with you totally that there's a huge danger of an educated, unemployed, you know, angry middle-class Pakistani turning against the United States. In fact, Pakistan is the most anti-American country in the world right now. And American policy has been sort of neglectful of that issue. On the other hand, that's why the Kerry Lugar Berman bill was passed, to provide development assistance and educational assistance to Pakistan. But the Pakistan military rejected that, and you know, for their own reasons. So it's very hard for Americans to influence Pakistan. I think that what is going to happen soon is that whether we like it or not, we're going to be forced out of Afghanistan. The Pakistani cutoff of aid, the aid flow to Afghanistan, is going to accelerate that. And then the Pakistanis will become maybe the dominant power in Afghanistan. Then we will see how effective the Pakistani government is in controlling the Afghan Taliban while battling the Pakistani Taliban. I'm very concerned that they will not be able to manage this because they've got so many internal problems of their own. You know, I foresee, you know, one alternative is a civil war in Afghanistan with Pakistan on one side and the Indians on the other side.
But we are supporting that corruption. We are supporting injustice there. If we are supporting people like Zardari, Nawaz Sharif,
my view is that we should support or work with whatever the government the Pakistani people want to elect, but not necessarily whatever government the Pakistan military puts in power. The problem is this is a Pakistani problem, not an American problem. All the Americans have contributed to it by playing ball with the military for 50, 60 years now. That is, Pakistan has never had a normal political system, and the burden of my book, several of my books, really is it's hard for America to deal with a country with an abnormal political system. We can't go in and change Pakistani politics. In fact, our efforts to do this have led to backlash in Pakistan. I think our policy should be one of let Pakistan alone for a while, let Pakistan solve its own problem.
I need to jump in here just very quickly. We're talking this morning with Stephen Cohen from the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. We're talking about current events in Pakistan. We will talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Michael Fassbender. In the past year, he starred in four films, playing a sex addict in Shame, Carl Jung in A Dangerous Method, Mr. Rochester in Jane Eyre, and a mutant villain in X-Men First Class. His other films include Inglourious Basterds, Fish Tank, and Hunger. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from Charleston Community Theater, presenting John Patrick Shanley's Pulitzer Prize-winning drama, Doubt, A Parable, this Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Tarbell Arts Center in Charleston. Seating is limited. Reservations at 217-581-ARTS. Details at charlestoncommunitytheater.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics for you, Monday through Friday. Tomorrow morning, we will talk with Joel Kutcher Gershenfeld. He's the Dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the U of I. Also joining us will be Wilma Liebman. She's the former chair of the National Labor Relations Board. It was from January 2009 until August of 2011. We'll talk about the NLRB and the role of collective bargaining in a civil society. And then also tomorrow, we will talk in the second hour with Paul Hammerness. He's assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Med School, and Margaret Moore. She's an executive wellness coach. They are the co-authors of the book, Organize Your Mind and Your Life, Train Your Brain to Get More Done in Less Time. We are here again weekday mornings from 10 until noon. You can check the schedule by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. The guest in this hour of focus is Stephen Cohen. He's at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow there, has been since 1998. Before that, he was a professor of political science here at University of Illinois, one of the founders of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. He's here visiting and will give a talk about Pakistan, sponsored by the folks there at ACTUS this afternoon at 3. He's authored a number of books about the politics of South Asia, and has been for a long time following the politics of both Pakistan and India. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I was interested in having you talk a little bit about Asif Ali Zardari. And here's a guy who, you know, came to the place where he is now because his wife was Benazir Bhutto. When she was assassinated, he assumed the leadership of her party. I think had that not happened, we wouldn't be talking about him being president of Pakistan.
Very much an accidental president.
A very accidental. But how's he done?
Well, you know, I think you have to look at this objectively. There's huge talk about his being corrupt and others being corrupt in Pakistan that may or may not be true. I'm you know, from Chicago, so corruption doesn't keep me up at night. You know, it's an issue. But what he has tried to do in the face of military opposition, in the face of civilian opposition is to undo some of the damage done to Pakistan in the past. He's tried to go back systematically and eliminate most of Zia-ul-Haq's, you know, Islamist reforms, so-called reforms, to put Pakistan on a more normal basis. But he's doing this in the midst of tensions with India, crises with India, serial crises with India, although now their normalization process has begun, and also very bad relations with the United States, and really a military intolerance of him. And also, I think, a civilian opposition that really is, I won't say irresponsible, but a civilian opposition that is feels that it must oppose and fight all the way. But they've tried to undo some of the damage of the past. But clearly Zardari, who's got a reputation as being a playboy in Pakistan, I think people underestimate him. And I've met him a couple of times, but I think he's, you know, while he's no intellectual and no genius, you look at some presidential debates that we've had, you wonder how any of these people could be president. So I think his heart's in the right place. They want to undo the damage of the past and move ahead. In a sense, his agenda is that of Benazir Bhutto, who's one of the few liberal progressive politicians that Pakistan has ever produced. Well, she had her faults and her problems, but clearly by the time she was killed, I knew her quite well then. She understood what had to be done, and his agenda is her agenda. The question is, can Pakistan achieve this agenda? And I'm concerned about the long-term survival of Pakistan, whether it can become a normal state ever again, and I have my doubts in some areas. For example, the economy is badly damaged, educational system is negative, it's getting worse, sectarian violence is increasing. It's a whole range of problems that Pakistan faces, and to try and normalize a country in this kind of trouble is a very difficult task, and I think we wouldn't care so much if it wasn't for the nuclear weapons, because they do make Pakistan a different country, and secondly, for their ability to support and train terrorists and export them all around the world. British terrorism is 70% based in Pakistan. That is, the terrorist acts in the UK can be traced back to Pakistan, at least 50% to 60% of them, and now to other terrorist episodes in other parts of the UK. And we've had our terrorist attacks here. The Times Square bombing was a Pakistani-based operation. So I think that Pakistan is important for these negative reasons. Its nuclear weapons program, its ability to function and, either as a matter of state policy or state incompetence, allow terrorism to flourish there and be exported elsewhere. So that's why we have to follow Pakistan. Mm-hmm.
Another caller, Champagne, again, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hello. Your former ACTUS colleague calling back again to engage in a little dialogue here. But it's been reported that the Pentagon and the CIA do indeed have plans to take out the Pakistani nukes. That could easily be done with cruise missiles and drone strikes. I think we know exactly where the nukes are. We have had Pakistan penetrated by intelligence agents and assets all up and down since 9/11, 2001, if not before then. In fact, a good deal of the Pakistani military have been trained by us, and they probably inform to us as to where their own nukes are. As for North Korea, our policy there has always been of implosion, like putting a nut in a nutcracker until it implodes, and then at that point taking their nukes out. So this baby Kim now, who's the new leader, I think indicates a severe degradation of whatever is going on there. He's obviously a figurehead, and if that's the best they can come up with, it doesn't look too good for them. So I go back to my point that I think our policy towards Pakistan is the same policy we have pursued toward Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan, North Korea. Ball is in your court.
Well, fortunately, it's a free country and you're allowed to voice your opinion, but I think that's a judgment based on no facts whatsoever. If you do an analysis of taking out a nuclear weapon, let alone taking out 50 or 100 of them, whether by cruise missile or otherwise, it's a very difficult, if not impossible, problem. We had a hard time finding Osama bin Laden, and the entire resources of the agency and the military and our intelligence services and other services were focused on finding him. When we did find him, it was a risky and dangerous operation, but it succeeded, fortunately. So if you can imagine 50 or 100 Osama bin Laden scattered around Pakistan, could we do that? We could do, presumably we could take care of a number of those weapons out, but it would only take one or two nuclear weapons on an American city or on an Indian city or some other city to make it an effort that would not be worthwhile. And that's the asset the Pakistanis have. They know that if we try and fail, they could still, you know, wreak their revenge on us one way or the other. And I think a loose nuke or a nuclear weapon given to a terrorist operation would be the way to go.
Well, if
I've never met an American policymaker who's willing to make that kind of risky kill.
If we are worried about these weapons and what we want is long-term is a stable Pakistan, is there anything that the United States can do in a constructive way to move in that direction?
Well, yeah, I favored the U.S.-India nuclear agreement. I was in favor of it because I thought that we could use that agreement to leverage India into many of the non-proliferation treaty norms. They couldn't sign the NPT as such, but they could behave as if they were an NPT state. And when they get into the various nuclear control regimes, technology control regimes, they will be that. I said, why not do this for Pakistan? Let the Pakistanis come clean over their past behavior, which was all negative, and let them be more transparent and more open. Let them subscribe to some of the NPT-type regimes around the world. Instead, because they're not in the system and we don't recognize the nuclear weapons program as legitimate in that sense, they blocked these kinds of fissile material control agreement. They actually blocked these arms control agreements. So I think that there's a grand bargain to be had here. You bring them in the tent at some compromise or some risk to the regime. But on the other hand, no state is going to go nuclear because it's not threatened. And the Pakistanis were threatened, which is why they went nuclear. The Iranians are halfway there anyway, so that's not going to affect Iranian policy. So I do think that we were foolish in not extending this kind of informal NPT outside the NPT agreement to Pakistan. We have done it, in effect, to North Korea. We've tolerated the North Korean program.
Is there anyone involved or even peripheral to Pakistani politics that you could point to and you could say, here's someone who would make a fabulous leader, someone who really has the potential to take the country forward?
I think that that's not a choice that Americans should be making. I think that's a choice that Pakistani people should be making. And there's a new political figure, Imran Khan, who's a famous cricket player who's people's joke and say he doesn't have a party, he has a fan club. And he's a charismatic guy, handsome, was a great cricket player. He did a lot of social service activities. But I don't think the Americans should be picking him or the army should be picking him. Let the Pakistani political process operate itself. Let the present government serve out its term. Let a new election be held. Let Imran be elected if he's electable. Let him succeed or fail on his own terms. I agree with some of the callers. We've been meddling in Pakistani politics too often. On the other hand, one reason we do it is that the Pakistanis come to the U.S. ambassador, whoever it is in Islamabad, and say, Mr. Ambassador or Ms. Ambassador, as the case has been, would you please support me? You know, the American role in Pakistan has been extremely intrusive. Unlike India, we've been meddling in Pakistani politics from day one, partly at Pakistani invitation. I think that's a bad habit we've gotten into.
About 5-6 minutes left. We have several callers. We'll get as many as we can. And next is someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have two questions, and I'll let you just kind of pick which one you think is most interesting / shortest to answer. The first is... Talking about Pakistan and India, so I'm a grad student here in political science, but I study American political behavior, so I'm not well-versed in this. Does the conflict there extend beyond just the regional conflict in Kashmir? And if so, sort of what's going into that political conflict, I guess? And then the second question, like I said, just pick one to answer, is I'm interested in public opinion, and so I was wondering what role, if any, does Pakistan public opinion play in that particular political crisis and in their dealings with the United States?
Okay.
Is there one kind of public opinion sentiment all focused in one direction, or is it scattered, and if so, does it even matter? Is the government responding to that?
Okay, I'll try to answer both questions very quickly. Public opinion used to not be a factor, but now with the new media in Pakistan, huge expansion of TV networks, there's like 80 cable systems. Even the military tell me that they cannot ignore public opinion, even as they try to manipulate and control public opinion, a trick they've learned from the Americans. So public opinion, or what they think public opinion is important. And the weaker the government is, the more important public opinion is, because they don't have legitimacy of an election. And the terms of your first question, the India-Pakistan dispute is the subject of a book I'm writing now, and it's going to look at 100 years of India-Pakistan conflict, and that'll take us up to 2047. And I think they will get that far unless Pakistan collapses in the meantime, because I don't see the dispute being based on Kashmir alone. It's based on identity. It's based on lack of regional integration. Pakistan, South Asia, is the least integrated region in the world, according to the World Bank. It's based on still distrust and suspicion in both countries, pathologies in both countries about the other. So I'm confident, if that's the right word, not the appropriate word, I believe that, in fact, this conflict will go on for another 30, 40 years. It's 100 years.
So you think 100 years after the creation of these states, they'll still be in the same place they are now?
It's very much like the Arabs and the Israelis, very similar, the same deep psychological problems on both sides, which prevent normalization. And when you look at what leads to normalization, sometimes it's a threat from the outside that brings two countries together. Sometimes it's the knitting and growing together of two societies. Sometimes it's a great power imposition of peace. There's a couple of books written about this. But in the case of the Middle East and South India and Pakistan, none of these factors are there. And there's current dialogue between India and Pakistan about normalizing trade. Well, when I see it happen, I'll believe it. I think that there's deep opposition to both countries to doing this, although there's good reasons to do it. And the Indian business community would like to have Pakistan sales in Pakistan, and the Pakistani software business would like to work with the Indians. But the military in Pakistan and I think the right-wing extremist in India oppose this kind of normalization process. It's self-defeating, self-destructive, but that's something we just have to live with for a while.
I thank the caller.
I'm writing a book about it, so I'll let you know the conclusion
in
2 years.
We'll do at least one more. This is also Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. In a way, I'm being repetitious, but it seems to me that the intrusion into Pakistan and Afghanistan by the Bush administration was utterly irresponsible and, frankly, downright stupid, with such a dependence on a very fragile supply route through the Khyber Pass. But what actually worries me now is it seems as though several of the presidential candidates this year seem to have learned absolutely nothing from this fiasco. And it gives me the impression that they're absolutely willing to repeat this kind of behavior in the future.
I think I disagree with you. I think that as I listen to the Republican debates, I don't think any of them have said we've got to stick it out and fight in Afghanistan.
I'm afraid of elsewhere.
Well,
military force at will.
Yeah, we don't know what's going to happen elsewhere, but in terms of their views on Afghanistan, I think they're all cautious, and they'd like to get out as soon as they can. And that's why Obama is pursuing a policy of withdrawing from Afghanistan, but presumably leaving behind some American military capability, which would shape events in Afghanistan. Even that may be problematic, so I think that's one of the most difficult decisions he's going to have to make. But I think he's decided to pull out sooner or later. But I don't see the Republicans eager to go anywhere else. I think they understand this country is in deep trouble economically. Our foreign interventions have backfired. I think none of them are defending Bush's intervention in Iraq or Afghanistan. In a sense, the danger may be extreme isolationism, as epitomized by Congressman Paul.
Well, Ron Paul certainly goes that way.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you're right.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Again, we'll do one more. Champaign, line three. Hello.
Yes, your old ACTUS colleague again. You still did not deal with the established fact that the Pentagon does have contingency plans to take out the Pakistani nukes. That's been even affirmed by them. Second, as for this Osama bin Laden, everyone knows that was just Hollywood theater. I have no idea who was killed there. Probably Osama bin Laden was killed in the bombing of Tora Bora. Everything after that, all these videos were clearly forgeries. It's no coincidence that this was conducted right as Obama was opening his presidential campaign so that he could say to the American people, look, I killed Osama bin Laden. So I don't think that proves anything. Finally, my final point, the dispute between Israel and the Arabs is not psychological. I was legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace negotiations from the beginning to the end, and also to the Syrian delegation to the Middle East peace negotiations. And once Rabin was in there as prime minister, we could have solved the whole thing then and there. And his own right-wing nationalists and religious fundamentalists murdered Rabin. And nothing has gone forward since then. Back to you.
I agree with the latter analysis. I think psychology is part of it, in a sense of the existence of pathological people in both among the Arabs community and among some Israelis contribute to this. But in the case of the Pentagon plans to scope up the Pakistani nukes, I have never heard or seen anything like this at all. I hate to tell you this, but Colonel Peters is alone in voicing this policy, and I don't think there is a contingency plan, except that I have a contingency plan when I become a millionaire to buy a place in Bermuda, but I don't expect to become a millionaire. So the Pentagon has plans for everything, but in fact, this kind of thing is not seriously considered by anybody in Washington or any other country for that matter. Everybody knows the difficulty would be in scooping up the Pakistani nukes. The greater fear is that Pakistan will collapse, and that in the process of collapsing or coming apart, and the Soviet Union is the closest analog to this, or Yugoslavia, although the Yugoslavs didn't have nukes, then some Pakistani in control of some nuclear weapons, there could be hundreds of nuclear weapons by that time, will decide, okay, I've had enough. I'm going to direct these nuclear weapons to the country that's torturing me, which is India or the United States or perhaps some other country. I think that's the greatest fear in Washington today. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's a presidential fear. Obama was elected on the platform of the worst contingency for America is a conjunction of nuclear weapons and Islamic terrorists. And where do you find them? You find them in Pakistan. I think that's the dominant concern in the United States. And therefore, any concept of planning to scoop them up and take them away, I don't know what you do with them. I just don't think that exists at all.
Well, we have about a minute, but again, the consensus, at least of some of the people that you brought together for this most recent book that you've done, is that this the kind of scenario that you talk about, it's something to worry about, although it's not going to happen next week or maybe next year.
No.
That you what you said earlier was you thought that probably the country would manage to limp along for at least for a few years.
Yeah,
but then
yeah.
There's a question of then what?
Yeah, I looked at the difficulty of predicting Pakistan, and my judgment was that the most we could do was look out 5 to 7 years. Okay. And that was the brief I gave to my co-authors, mm-hmm. and that's what they did. If you look beyond 5 to 7 years, if you track, if you include the expanding nuclear program, the declining economic program, the declining educational system, then it becomes more troublesome, I think, after 5 to 7 years. That's 2 prime ministers from now, perhaps, or 2-3 army chiefs from now. I think that's very troubling, and I'm not sure what we're going to be doing when that time does come. In fact, I'd like to have another conference 5 to 7 years from now and say, who was right and who was wrong?
And the title of this most recent book is?
The Future of Pakistan.
All right. And it's a Brookings publication?
Brookings, yeah, just right. Published by Brookings.
Our guest, Stephen
Cohen. A lot of it is online, in fact, at Brookings. So.
Stephen Cohen is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, former professor of political science here at University of Illinois. We'll be giving a talk on the topic Pakistan, a continuing crisis and uncertain future this afternoon at 3 on the campus of the University of Illinois. It's sponsored by the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, a program that he helped start. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be back in town.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 51 years of service to music education. The Music Shop serves over 200 school music programs with band and orchestra instruments, a large sheet music department, thousands of accessories, and private lessons at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
That's it for us here on Focus. Again, just a reminder that you can check the schedule, find out what is up for the days ahead, or if you'd like to go back and listen to past programs, get more information about what you hear and see on our stations, just go to our website. That is will.illinois.edu. That's the website. You can check it out. And for us, that's where we'll finish for this morning, but there's more coming up in the way of news, weather, features, other things, all part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Let's take a look at commodity prices. They are lower in Kansas City and in Chicago at a minute and a half before noon Central Time. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at 660 and three quarters, down 12 and a quarter. May, down 12 and a quarter at 669 and three quarters. In Chicago, March wheat, 593 and three quarters, down 11. May, 616 and three quarters, down 11 and a quarter. March corn, 594 and a half, down 9 and a half. May, 601 and three quarters, down 9. July, 606, down 9 and three quarters. September, 571 and a quarter, down 10 and a quarter. March soybeans, 1175 and three quarters, down 7 and three quarters. May, 1184 and a half, down 8. July, 1193, down 9. August, 1191, down 9 and three quarters. March meal, 309 even, down 150. March soybean oil, 5027, down 50. February live cattle, 123.07 and a half, down 45. April, 126.47 and a half, down 32 and a half. January feeder cattle, 150.72 and a half, up 7 and a half. February lean hogs, 86.45, that's up 67 and a half. Outside markets, February crude, $100.66, that's down a nickel. The U.S. dollar, 80.54, down 64. The CRB index, 310.31, that is off 52. On Wall Street, at last check, the